This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, January 1st, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Today, we bring you a special documentary from Kenya. Whose land is it anyway? Please stay with us. Land across great swaths of the developing world has become a prime target for foreign investors. This affects communities living off the land and those throughout the region. Feeding the growing global population is one of the greatest challenges of the coming decades, and how land is used is at the core of the debate. The divide between the haves and the have-nots is growing. Each night, nearly 1 billion people go to bed hungry, while over a billion are substantially overfed, according to the UK government's Office for Science. Today, we'll explore these issues by looking at what's happening in Kenya. There, some proponents of foreign investments say there's promise and potential for residents. But as FSRN's Zach Brophy reports, it's often the local communities and those most in need who lose out.
A couple of cattle herders attending to their animals on the edge of the expansive Yala swamp in western Kenya. They are angry. They have been cut adrift from their traditional grazing grounds, which are fenced off as a private farm owned by a foreign investor. Their story reflects a fate shared by many across the developing world. In recent years, investors have flocked to countries such as Kenya to put their money in land. It has been a divisive trend. A litany of disputes has emerged, with local communities claiming to have been dispossessed, disenfranchised, and deceived. Yet many people argue that these are a minority of cases, and that such investments are necessary to lift families and communities out of poverty and to feed the coming generations.
The problem we have is land. But as you can see, this big chunk of land used to be ours. We used to graze and we used to do everything there without anything happening. So the biggest problem is land. Yes.
Fred is one of the cattle herders at the Yala Swamp, but his fortunes have taken a turn for the worst. He traces his grievances back to 2003 when the Oklahoma-based Dominion Group of Companies secured a 45-year lease for 7,000 hectares of the swamp, an area around 20 times the size of Central Park in New York. Nearly a decade later, the American firm has developed fish ponds, cattle pastures and rice, soya and cornfields. But it is also embroiled in a bitter and costly dispute with the locals.
When we talk about the decision-making, as per my understanding, we are not involved in any decision-making because we were only told there is a company coming. In fact, when the president of the firm came first, they came on a crusade. It was a crusade of saying that they're preaching. They didn't say that we have a farm. It was preaching. And he preached and he preached, and then we went back. The third one, when he came, he told us he's going just to drain the water for us. He's going to reclaim the land for us. Then all of a sudden, we just saw him coming with all these things and then fencing and all that. So the decision-making on how the Dominion was coming and what the Dominion was going to do, we were not told. And up to date, nobody has bothered to tell us, regardless of several questions that we have been asking about the coming of Dominion.
The Yala Swamp is in an impoverished corner of Kenya, with most of the neighbouring communities living in mud huts with potholed tracks for roads. The swamp is a source of fish and water and maintains agricultural land and pastures. Many residents resent having been cut off from land and resources that they used to rely on, and several complained of having been forced and coerced to move. Having visited many of the communities in the Yala Swamp area, I'm now on the other side of the fence in the Dominion Farms, which are, if anything, impressive in their size. They're stretching to my right and to the left, there's massive rice and soya and maize paddy fields, over 10,000 acres of cultivated land in total. I'm standing next to a wide irrigation ditch, and perhaps you can hear in the background the frogs in the fields and in the irrigation channels. So I'm now going to head up to meet with Chris Abir, who's the manager of the farm.
Let's say Dominion is such a monster, but let somebody come and say this monster is at least producing 6 million tilapia and selling locally and improving the diet of the people that live around Lake Victoria that like fish and the lake is depleted. These people are producing at least 10 million kilos of rice every season that is feeding our people. These people are producing some maize. These people are employing somebody. Why does publicity have to be negative?
Both the residents that I spoke to and Chris Abir were in agreement that there was corruption among local politicians. But while the community accused Dominion Farms of manipulating the council representatives to get a free rein over the land, Chris Abir blamed a handful of the politicians of turning the community against the farm when they refused to become a cash cow of expected bribes.
If you look up at the history of the entrance of Dominion Farms, there were several meetings that were held at various levels, community and so on. And then the final document, which is the MOU, was signed by the community in representative. I don't know how it is in other countries, but in Kenya, if you select the councillor, the MP, they are your representative. They make laws for you. They decide things. And these are the same people that the community elected. They went and they signed these documents and they said, this is what Dominion Farms is going to do. Now, how do you blame Dominion Farms for their representative signing this document?
The bad blood between the Yellow Swamp residents and Dominion Farms is an example of how such deals can turn sour if communities are not at the heart of the decision-making process. Such disputes have become increasingly common in recent years.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, May 30th, 2008. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, or FAO, says that agricultural commodity prices should ease from their recent record peaks.
This FSRN report was from the height of the global food crisis in 2008. Over the previous 2 years, the prices of staples had skyrocketed by up to 200%, and the shockwaves in the market sparked a rush for investments in agricultural land. Before 2008, the average expansion of global agricultural land was less than 4 million hectares a year. Yet according to the World Bank, by the end of 2009, approximately 56 million hectares of large-scale farmland deals were announced. Around a third of those were in sub-Saharan Africa.
Land grabbing on a great scale is the first step in creating a field for the establishment of agriculture on a great scale. Hence, the subversion of agriculture puts on, at first, more the appearance of a political revolution.
Academics are gathered at the Institute of Development Studies in the UK, where Ian Schoons is introducing a conference on so-called land, water and green grabbing. He is a research fellow at the Institute and a joint convener of the Future Agricultures Consortium.
There are a number of areas that are converging all at one time and they interact. I mean, first there is a growing demand for food. Second, there's a growing demand for energy. Third, there is a growing demand for safe investments. And then combined with this, there are also demands for securing carbon rights and environmental protection. And all of these are interacting together to drive land investments globally.
Fertile lands in Africa, Asia and Latin America have enticed investors from across the globe. Countries that are capital rich but food scarce, such as Saudi Arabia or Qatar, seek to secure their food sources abroad. Land is also proving an attractive safety option for investment bodies such as banks and pension funds. And among the biggest players are emerging market investors from the likes of China and India. Ian Schoons.
There have been a lot of studies done of these new investments, and of course many of them are only starting up now, so it's very difficult to assess the longer term impacts. But a lot of them are focused on investing in biofuels or export crops, which don't necessarily have a direct and immediate impact, positive impact on food security at a local level or poverty reduction. They may in the longer term provide employment and therefore provide livelihoods for people. But the grand mass of evidence to date shows that land deals haven't been beneficial for poor people and haven't been beneficial for local level food security.
This station is Euston Bank Branch. Change here for southbound Northern Line services via Charing Cross from Platform 2, Victoria Line.
Much of the capital for foreign investments in land comes from global financial hubs such as the City of London. Doug Hawkins is the Director of Agribusiness at the UK-based capital markets advisory firm Hardman & Co.
The things that you can do to increase production require investment, and that's investment which isn't affordable by subsistence farmers. And it's investment which probably is best made on a certain scale of activity.
The challenges are certainly huge. By 2050, global food production will need to increase by around 70%, according to the World Bank. And yet, competition for land, water and energy are only going to intensify. With much of Africa currently suffering land degradation and achieving yields of only around a third of their potential, significant change is clearly a necessity. But the question is how? Doug Hawkins sees investment in land as the key.
If you have the land, land ownership or long leases as a collateral for raising finance, you have a mechanism to draw down commercial debt to invest in your property and develop it. And we've seen this obviously, you know, create successful farming models across the world, whether it's Australia, New Zealand, Canada, America, Europe, it doesn't really matter. But there are real issues when you cannot use the land as a collateral. And in many African economies, that is the case.
To put that into layman's terms, in order to raise the cash that is needed to fund development, it is necessary to clearly define land markets and then open them up to investors. The problem is determining who has the right to sign on the dotted line when land is shared between a community. This is very common in Africa and was the case at the Yala Swamp, where the district councils made the deal on behalf of the local people.
It is in the record that leaders in Kenya, quite few, are honest. All of them are going after money.
Erasto Adindo is the chairman of the Yala Social Movement. He is a local, small-scale farmer, and he claims to have lost land due to flooding behind a small dam built at Dominion Farms.
So if you choose to work with a leader, then you'll always be going by the opinion of that particular leader. And Dominion was very much okay with the leaders, because leaders, they will take them to a hotel, they will agree on something that will even kill people the following day, but they don't care.
To understand the ambiguous arrangement of land ownership at the heart of the conflict, it is necessary to go back in history. Adenda Lumumba is the head of the Kenya Land Alliance and an expert on African land issues.
The major legacy of colonialism in Africa and in Kenya was a legacy of dispossession. Dispossession that created historical land injustices. Dispossession that created landlessness. Dispossession that encouraged agricultural enterprise for settler community other than the native communities. So that legacy is being addressed, and we are addressing.
And what about the land policies of the successive governments? I mean, it's been like 50 years now. We're talking post-colonial.
50 years from independence were wasted decades.
The patchwork of private, public, and community land that exists today is highly politicized, and oftentimes poorly defined. In many cases, communities like those around the Yala Swamp have been distanced from the decision-making process over the land on which they live. In recent years, there have been a number of developments in Kenya to try and shift the decision-making power back to these people. Adenda Lumumba again.
Kenya is undergoing land reforms. We have changed our tenure systems, essentially by recognizing customary tenure in what we call community land tenure. That recognition in law essentially means that the customary tenure can equally vibrantly be dealt with at a market level. One of the other things is that it will now help to protect the property of those who own land under customary tenure.
The reforms revolve around the new constitution that was passed in 2010 and three new land laws. As Kenya grapples with the implementation of the new legislation, hundreds of thousands of acres of land deals have been put on hold.
There's a conflict from government side, because on one side we have put in laws, the constitution that protects the rights of communities to their land. But on the other hand, we need direct investment all investment will invariably be on land.
Pauli Mukutso is the program officer at the Kenyan NGO, the Institute for Land and Environmental Governance.
So we still have not, as government, has not reached that balance. And so that's what now our next frontier, civil society, to make sure that whereas we are saying we want the investment because we're not saying we don't want foreign direct investment in land. We want that, but it has to be done within a context that does not make the communities more poorer or worse off than before the investment. That's the balance that we want to get.
Going back to what you're saying, though, you need to have a strong civil society and laws, land laws in place.
Yes.
if you're going to encourage those kind of investments?
Yes. One of the areas that we also want to push for is just transparency in government. What when you invite or when you allow a company to come and invest in thousands of hectares of land, what are the contracts? What are we benefiting as a country? You know, let them be open because they have been very secretive in the past.
You are listening to a special FSRN documentary, Whose Land Is It Anyway? By reporter Zach Brophy. Please stay with us.
One of the major players in this surge in investments in agricultural land across the developing world is the World Bank Group. Within this group, the International Finance Corporation is the arm that gives investment support and advice to encourage private sector development in countries such as Kenya. Their office is for sub-Saharan Africa in Nairobi, so that is where I've come to meet with their communications officer, Neha Sud, and investment analyst, Zara Khan.
In general, investment overall is a good thing. Why would a country like Rwanda want to improve their doing business environment? They want to diversify their economy. They want to bring in different types of players in their country. They don't want to stay as an agrarian economy. They want to transform to a different level. What does that take? It could take having to show that we're friendly to our own diaspora coming back from Europe, people that have left 10 years ago, 20 years ago. We want them to come back. What is inspiring them to come back after they've dealt with an environment where maybe 10, 20 years ago they were disenfranchised? Well, this business report can show that Rwanda has improved. So it's more under the umbrella that business in general will improve growth in the country, and that should be a good thing for society if it's sustainable, responsible investing.
The World Bank Group's role in promoting the opening up of land markets across much of the developing world has drawn criticism from a number of different sectors. The growing basket of reports of unscrupulous land deals has added fuel to the fire. A major 2011 World Bank report on the topic contain numerous warnings about how many investments in land were having negative impacts. One passage reads,
"Official records on land acquisitions are often incomplete, and neglect of social and environmental norms is widespread. All of this implies the danger of a race to the bottom to attract investors."
So why does the World Bank Group still follow policies promoting large-scale investments in land? Neha Sud.
It is difficult to make the link that if an investment in land has led to a certain negative effect, that is due to advisory services provided by IFC, because that is quite a leap to make.
I mean, there's been a surge in these kind of investments in the last, say, 5-6 years, and that is partly due to the changes in regulations which has happened at the behest of the World Bank Group.
I wouldn't agree, because I think you cannot say that there's more foreign investment coming into Africa. I mean, it would be very congratulatory for us to say that there's more foreign...
I'm talking about specifically in land. I'm not talking about FDI in general. I'm talking, sticking on the land issue.
Again, I think that is a connection that is difficult to make. Yes, the World Bank Group provides advisory services which help governments create an enabling environment for business, yet beyond that, the World Bank Group's role is limited to providing advisory services on issues like better governance, on issues like performance standards, environmental and social. We do know that there are bad practices that continue in the countries, but our role is limited to providing the advisory services, to putting in the systems that can encourage good practice, yet the individual investment decisions that are made are not necessarily hand in hand with the World Bank Group.
A particularly vocal critic of the role played by the World Bank Group in affecting national land policies is the US-based think tank, the Oakland Institute. They published a damning report in November 2011, and Anuradha Mittal is the executive director.
So, for instance, when countries are told to become attractive, the kind of strategic investor status they're providing to investors, where they don't have to pay, you know, profit taxes for 10 years or 20, 30 years, where 100% repatriation of profits is allowed, where you don't have to pay import duties, just according to IMF, that kind of loss of tax revenue is devastating for developing economies. We have looked at over 80 land deals in Africa in different countries. It's a very standard procedure. These people come and say, hey, look, we are going to take the risk and invest in your country. What you going to give? This is the laundry list. And in case of Zambia, I mean, the whole scheme they have at the encouragement of the World Bank Group, the farm block scheme, they even took a loan from the World Bank to put in the infrastructure. So, you know, when you say, oh, there'll be infrastructure development, blah, 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 it's like, you even took a loan to put in the infrastructure for the foreign investors, something you wouldn't do for your smallholder farmers?
Back at the Yellow Swamp, I met with some villagers as they sat chatting outside a couple of small mud huts. I spoke with some of the women to get their take on the arrival of Dominion Farms. Madam, can you just tell me how your life has changed since Dominion Farms came to the area?
I used to grow vegetables and maize over there, and we could graze our cattle there. We no longer have access and have been squeezed out.
Now that you can't do that, how do you support yourself and your family?
I have to beg for food from relatives and other people. I have nowhere left to farm.
Now, madam, perhaps I can turn to you because I believe you were actually employed at Dominion Farms. Can you tell me a little bit about your experiences working there?
They were long days with our hands and legs in the water, and the chemicals they used would irritate your skin. And some of the women started to have premature births. The water is being ruined.
And how much did you get paid?
I got paid 2,000 shillings every 2 weeks, which is around $2 a day. It wasn't enough to sustain a family.
Dominion Farms argues that its wages are in line with government regulations and denies that its farming practices are damaging to the environment or the health of their workers. But the women's concerns highlight a number of recurring themes in similar disputes. Women are often overlooked when negotiating land deals, and yet a 2011 report by the UK government on the future of food and farming noted that empowering women and focusing on their challenges brings much wider gains in terms of reducing poverty and increasing productivity. Pauline Makutsu from the Kenyan Institute for Land and Environmental Governance.
First of all, the women have very little control in, even when there's a consultation. When they come to negotiate over how much they want to lease out their land, the women are not involved because it's the heads of the families that, and that those are the men, the fathers or the sons. And those are the ones that are called for the meetings, and they are the ones who will decide yes or no and how much each will get. The women, their participation is very minimal, and yet they are the greater users of the land. For example, the men, like in the Tana River area, the men will deal with cattle. They will graze the cattle, they raise the cattle, but the women will farm to grow food to supplement their diets. They will go to the forest, collect firewood, collect water. They have a greater role to play in terms of getting the resources from the land.
The women at the Yellow Swamp Village also touched on a dispute over water. In many major land investments, water is perhaps more critical than the land itself, but receives less attention. Ian Schoons at the Institute of Development Studies.
Well, water is clearly a different type of resource to land because you can't put a fence around it. It flows around, and therefore there are different issues around capturing it. But while you can be sold a lease for land, rights over water are much less easily defined, and too often people haven't defined water rights in the same way as land rights. So even if a reasonably transparent, secure process happened over the land deal, questions of water are always there. And we must think increasingly about water and broader environmental questions at the same time as land deals.
Many of the large land deals in Africa fall along the major rivers and their tributaries, such as the Upper Nile and the Niger. This has sparked accusations not just of land grabbing, but of water grabbing too. Adenda Lumumba from the Kenya Land Alliance.
The remaining source of water is found in the rural areas, where the majority of the African population is residing. And this is the area which is targeted for the large-scale land acquisition. And that has been along the riverines and the estuaries that are remaining in Africa with some water. So you can as well say that the large-scale land acquisition is really targeting to colonize the water sources that are, that remain in Africa. And by so doing, we are pushing away the local communities further away from the water sources by huge land enclosures.
A number of business-led initiatives, such as the Principles for Responsible Agricultural Investment, have been created to manage the surge in land investments. They encourage companies to act in a transparent and socially and environmentally conscious manner. But in practice, they often lack teeth. The challenge lies in developing transparent and responsible governments accountable to informed and empowered local communities. Investment advisor Doug Hawkins.
It's in the hands of African governments to establish laws surrounding the utilisation of land and the regulation of how that land is used in the best interests of their people. That's got to be the starting point. And it would be inappropriate for any government to rely on an incoming investor to self-regulate. That's just blindingly obvious.
At the Yala Swamp, Erasto Adindo's farm may be at the heart of the land dispute with Dominion Farms, but he still believes local farmers and foreign investors can work together, but only under certain conditions.
But what you should get straight from me, that we are not against any development coming to this country. We'll support development 100%.
But, there's a but.
But, only investment that is out to uplift the living standard of the people who offered land for them. Because I cannot offer you land, at the same time you mistreat me in my own home, that one is not investment. You're out to finish us. So I don't know this development is for who. Even us, we want to be millionaires. We want to produce something and take to the airport. Doesn't mean that if I was born poor, I should remain poor. No.
The World Bank's 2011 report, Rising Global Interest in Farmland, noted,
without any expansion of cultivated area, large increases in output and welfare for the poorest groups could be possible through efforts to enable existing farmers to use currently cultivated land more productively.
Investment schemes that bring local producers on board, such as joint ventures, contract farming, or outgrower schemes, can help advance the output and capacity of local producers without any large-scale transitions in control and ownership of land. Adenda Lumumba.
Any foreign investment must come to help augment local production. And the biggest need for the local people is basically to see an investment that will also help them to acquire modern know-how technologically to improve their production, in which case they can produce production and become the main suppliers of raw materials as outgrowers to the main investor. So the investor must come in into areas where the local capital is unable to make a difference.
Transport infrastructure, storage and refrigeration facilities, modern meatpacking plants, access to markets and technical training are all woefully deficient in Africa. By developing these capacities, whilst keeping the people on the land, the logic follows that local, small-scale farmers can advance to medium and perhaps even large-size operations. So farmers, like Erasto Adindo, can break out of the cycle of poverty and, as he says, perhaps one day become a millionaire too.
Today's documentary, Whose Land Is It Anyway?, was produced by FSRN reporter Zach Brophy and edited by Shannon Young. Our technical producer at KPFA in Berkeley was Puck Lowe. Music by Thomas Mapfuno. To download or hear this documentary again, visit our website at fsrn.org. We'll be back with our regular newscast tomorrow. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.